yield. They had a certain beauty, which I admired in a detached sort of way, but it was the beauty of strength and competence, the assurance of power that made its form admirable. It was the same hand now, pale and long-fingered, the knuckles slightly bony, oddly bare without my ring, but recognisably my hand. Yet it lay in a hand so much larger and rougher that it seemed small and fragile by comparison. His other hand squeezed tighter, pressing the metal of the silver ring into my flesh, reminding me of what remained. I lifted his fist and pressed it hard against my heart in answer. The rain began to fall in large wet drops, but neither of us moved. It came in a rush, dropping a veil over boat and shore, pattering noisily on leaves and deck and water, lending a temporary illusion of concealment. It washed cool and soft across my skin, momentary balm on the wounds of fear and loss. I felt at once horribly vulnerable, and yet completely safe. But then, I had always felt that way with Jamie Fraser. Part 4. River Run. Chapter 10. Jocasta. Cross Creek, North Carolina, June 1767. River Run stood by the edge of the Cape Fear, just above the confluence that gave Cross Creek its name. Cross Creek itself was good-sized, with a busy public wharf and several large warehouses lining the water's edge. As the Sally Ann made her way slowly through the shipping lane, a strong resinous smell hung over the town and river, trapped by the hot, sticky air. "Jesus, it's like breathing turpentine," Ian wheezed, as a fresh wave of the stultifying reek washed over us.
"You is breathing turpentine, man."
Eutroclus's rare smile flashed white and disappeared. He nodded toward a barge tethered to a piling by one of the wharfs. It was stacked with barrels, some of which showed a thick black ooze through split seams. Other, larger barrels bore the brand marks of their owners, with a large T burned into the pinewood below.
"That's right," Captain Freeman agreed.
He squinted in the bright sunlight, waving one hand slowly in front of his nose, as though this might dispel the stink.
"This time of year's when the pitch boilers come down from the back country. Pitch, turpentine, tar. Bring it all down by barge to Wilmington, then send it on south to the shipyards at Charleston."
"I shouldn't think it's all turpentine," Jamie said.
He mopped the back of his neck with a handkerchief and nodded toward the largest of the warehouses, its door flanked by red-coated soldiers.
"Smell it, Sassenach."
I inhaled cautiously. There was something else in the air here, a hot, familiar scent. "Rum," I said.
"And brandywine, and a bit of port as well."
Jamie's long nose twitched, sensitive as a mongoose's. I looked at him in amusement. "You haven't lost it, have you?" 20 years before, he had managed his cousin Jared's wine business in Paris, and his nose and palate had been the awe of the winery tasting rooms. He grinned.
"Oh, I expect I could still tell Moselle from horse piss if you held it right under my nose. But telling rum from turpentine is no great feat, is it?"
Ian drew a huge lungful of air and let it out, coughing.
"It all smells the same to me," he said, shaking his head.
"Good," said Jamie. "I'll give you turpentine next time I stand you a drink. It'll be a good deal cheaper." "Turpentine's just about what I could afford now," he added under the cover of the laughter this remark caused.
He straightened, brushing down the skirts of his coat.
"We'll be there soon. Do I look a terrible beggar, Sassenach?"
Seen with the sun glowing on his neatly ribboned hair, his darkened profile coin-stamped against the light, I thought privately he looked dazzling. But I had caught the faint tone of anxiety in his voice, and knew well enough what he meant. Penniless he might be, but he didn't mean to look it. I was well aware that the notion of appearing at his aunt's door as a poor relation come a-begging stung his pride considerably. The fact that he had been forced into precisely that role didn't make it any easier to bear. I looked him over carefully, The coat and waistcoat were not spectacular, but quite acceptable, courtesy of Cousin Edwin. A quiet grey broadcloth with a good hand and an excellent fit. Buttons, not silver, but not of wood or bone either. A sober pewter, like a prosperous Quaker. Not that the rest of him bore the slightest resemblance to a Quaker, I thought. The linen shirt was rather grubby, but as long as he kept his coat on, no one would notice, and the missing button on the waistcoat was hidden by the graceful fall of his lace jabot, the sole extravagance he had permitted himself in the way of wardrobe.
The stockings were all right. Pale blue silk, no visible holes. The white linen breeches were tight, but not quite indecent, and reasonably clean.
The shoes were the only real flaw in his ensemble. There had been no time to have any made. His were sound, and I'd done my best to hide the scuff marks with a mixture of soot and dripping, but they were clearly a farmer's footwear, not a gentleman's. Thick-soled, made of rough leather, and with buckles of lowly horn. Still, I doubted that his Aunt Jocasta would be looking at his feet first thing. I stood on tiptoe to straighten his jabot, and brushed a floating down feather off his shoulder. "It will be all right," I whispered back, smiling up at him. "You're beautiful." He looked startled, then the expression of grim aloofness relaxed into a smile. "You're beautiful, Sassenach." He leaned over and kissed me on the forehead. "You're flushed as a wee apple. Very bonny." He straightened up, glanced at Ian, and sighed.
"As for Ian, perhaps I can pass him off as a bondsman I've taken on to be swineherd."
Ian was one of those people whose clothes, no matter what their original quality, immediately look as though they'd been salvaged from a rubbish tip. Half his hair had escaped from its green ribbon, and one bony elbow protruded from a rip in his new shirt, whose cuffs are already noticeably grey round the wrists.
"Captain Freeman says we'll be there in no time," he exclaimed, eyes shining with excitement as he leaned over the side, peering upriver in order to be first to sight our destination. "What do you think we'll get for supper?"
Jamie surveyed his nephew with a marked lack of favour.
"I expect you'll get table scraps with the dogs. Do you not own a coat, Ian, or a comb?"
"Oh, aye," Ian said, glancing round vaguely as though expecting one of these objects to materialise in front of him.
"Have a coat here. Somewhere, I think."
The coat was finally located under one of the benches, and extracted with some difficulty from the possession of Rollo, who had made a comfortable bed of it. After a quick brush to remove at least some of the dog hairs from the garment, Ian was forcibly inserted into it and sat firmly down to have his hair combed and plaited, while Jamie gave him a quick refresher course in manners, this consisting solely of the advice to keep his mouth shut as much as possible. Ian nodded amiably.
"Will you tell Great Auntie Jocasta about the pirates yourself, then?" he inquired.
Jamie glanced briefly at Captain Freeman's scrawny back. It was futile to expect that such a story wouldn't be told in every tavern in Cross Creek as soon as they had left us. It would be a matter of days, hours perhaps, before it spread to River Run Plantation.
"Aye, I'll tell her," he said, "but not just on the instant, Ian. Let her get accustomed to us first."
The mooring for River Run was some distance above Cross Creek, separated from the noise and reek of the town by several miles of tranquil, tree-thick river. Having seen Jamie, Ian, and Fergus all rendered as handsome as water, comb, and ribbons could make them, I retired to the cabin, changed out of my grubby muslin, sponged myself hastily, and slipped into the cream silk I had worn to dinner with the governor. The soft fabric was light and cool against my skin. Perhaps a bit more formal than was usual for afternoon, but it was important to Jamie that we must look decent, especially now, after our encounter with the pirates, and my only alternatives were the filthy muslin or a clean but threadbare camlet gown that had travelled with me from Georgia. There wasn't a great deal to be done with my hair. I gave it a cursory stab with a comb, then tied it back off my neck, letting the ends curl up as they would. I needn't trouble about jewellery, I thought ruefully, and rubbed my silver wedding ring to make it shine. I still avoided looking at my left hand, so nakedly bare. If I didn't look, I could still feel the imaginary weight of the gold upon it. By the time I emerged from the cabin, the mooring was in sight. By contrast to the rickety fittings of most plantation moorings we had passed, River Run boasted a substantial and well-built wooden dock. A small black boy was sitting on the end of it, swinging bare legs in boredom. When he saw the Sally Ann's approach, he leapt to his feet and tore off, presumably to announce our arrival. Our homely craft bumped to a stop against the dock. From the screen of trees near the river, a brick walk swept out through a broad array of formal lawns and gardens, splitting in two to circle paired marble statues that stood in their own beds of flowers, then joining again and fanning out in a broad piazza in front of an imposing two-storied house, colonnaded and multi-chimneyed. At one side of the flower bed stood a miniature building made of white marble, a mausoleum of some kind, I thought. I revised my opinions as to the suitability of the cream silk dress and touched nervously at my hair. I found her at once among the people hurrying out of the house and down the walk. I would have known her for a Mackenzie even if I hadn't known who she was. She had the bold bones, the broad Viking cheekbones, and high smooth brow of her brothers, Colum and Dougal. And like her nephew, like her great-niece, she had the extraordinary height that marked them all as descendants of one blood. A head higher than the bevy of black servants who surrounded her, she floated down the path from the house, hand on the arm of her butler, though a woman less in need of support I had seldom seen. She was tall, and she was quick, with a firm step at odds with the white of her hair. She might once have been as red as Jamie. Her hair still held a tinge of ruddiness, having gone that rich, soft white that redheads do, with the buttery patina of an old gold spoon. There was a cry from one of the little boys in the vanguard, and two of them broke loose, galloping down the path toward the moorings, where they circled us, yapping like puppies. At first I couldn't make out a word. It was only as Ian replied jocularly to them that I realized they were shouting in Gaelic. I didn't know whether Jamie had thought what to say or to do upon this first meeting, but in the event, he simply stepped forward, went up to Jocasta Mackenzie, and embraced her, saying, "Aunt, it's Jimmy." It was only as he released her and stepped back that I saw his face, with an expression I had never seen before, something between eagerness, joy, and awe. It occurred to me, with a small jolt of shock, that Jocasta Mackenzie must look very much like her elder sister, Jamie's mother. I thought she might have his deep blue eyes, though I couldn't tell. They were blurred as she laughed through her tears, holding him by the sleeve, reaching up to touch his cheek, to smooth non-existent strands of hair from his face. "Jamie," she said over and over, "Jamie, wee Jamie, oh, I'm glad you've come, lad." She reached up once more and touched his hair, a look of amazement on her face. "Blessed bride, but he's a giant. He'll be as tall as my brother Dougal was, at least." The expression of happiness on his face faded slightly at that, but he kept his smile, turning her with him so she faced me. "Auntie, may I present my wife? This is Claire." She put out a hand at once, beaming, and I took it between my own, feeling a small pang of recognition at the long, strong fingers. Though her knuckles were slightly knobbed with age, her skin was soft, and the feel of her grip was unnervingly like Brianna's. "I'm so glad to meet you, my dear," she said, and drew me close to kiss my cheek. The scent of mint and verbena wafted strongly from her dress, and I felt oddly moved, as though I had suddenly come under the protection of some beneficent deity. "So beautiful," she said admiringly, long fingers stroking the sleeve of my dress. "Thank you," I said. But Ian and Fergus were coming up to be introduced in their turn.
She greeted them both with embraces and endearments, laughing as Fergus kissed her hand in his best French manner. "Come," she said, breaking away at last, and wiping at her wet cheeks with the back of a hand. "Do come in, my dearies, and take a dish of tea and some food. You'll be famished, no doubt, after such a journey. Ulysses!" She turned, seeking, and her butler stepped forward, bowing low.
"Madam," he said to me, and "Sir," to Jamie. "Everything is ready, Miss Jewel," he said softly to his mistress, and offered her his arm.
As they started up the brick walk, Fergus turned to Ian and bowed, mimicking the butler's courtly manner, then offered an arm in mockery. Ian kicked him neatly in the backside and walked up the path, head turning from side to side to take in everything. His green ribbon had come undone and was dangling halfway down his back. Jamie snorted at the horseplay, but smiled nonetheless.
"Madam."
He put out an arm to me, and I took it, sweeping rather grandly up the path to the doors of River Run, flung wide to greet us. The house was spacious and airy inside, with high ceilings and wide French doors in all the downstairs rooms. I caught a glimpse of silver and crystal as we passed a large formal dining room, and thought that on the evidence Hector Cameron must have been a very successful planter indeed. Jocasta led us to her private parlour, a smaller, more intimate room, no less well furnished than the larger rooms, but which sported homely touches among the gleam of polished furniture and the glitter of ornaments. A large knitting basket full of yarn balls sat on a small table of polished wood, beside a glass vase spilling summer flowers and a small ornate silver bell. A spinning wheel turned slowly by itself in the breeze from the open French doors. The butler escorted us into the room, saw his mistress seated, then turned to a sideboard that held a collection of jugs and bottles.
"You'll have a dram to celebrate your coming, Jamie."
Jocasta waved a long, slim hand in the direction of the sideboard.
"I shouldn't have think you'll have tasted decent whisky since you left Scotland, eh?"
Jamie laughed, sitting down opposite her.
"Indeed not, Aunt. And how'd you come by it here?"
She shrugged and smiled, looking complacent.
"Your uncle had the luck to lay down a good stock some years ago. He took a half a shipload of wine and liquor in trade for a warehouse of tobacco, meaning to sell it. But then the Parliament passed an act making it illegal for any but the Crown to sell any liquor stronger than ale in the colonies, and so we ended with 200 bottles of the stuff in the wine cellar."
She stretched out her hand toward the table by her chair, not bothering to look. She didn't need to. The butler set down a crystal tumbler softly, just where her fingers would touch it. Her hand closed around it, and she lifted it, passing it under her nose and sniffing, eyes closed in sensual delight.
"There's a good bit left of it yet. A great deal more than I can guzzle by myself, I'll tell you."
She opened her eyes and smiled, lifting the tumbler toward us.
"To you, nephew, and your dear wife, may you find this house home, Slange."
"Slange of Ar,"
Jamie answered, and we all drank.
It was good whisky, smooth as buttered silk and heartening as sunshine.
I could feel it hit the pit of my stomach, take root and spread up my backbone. It seemed to have a similar effect on Jamie. I could see the slight frown between his brows ease as his face relaxed.
"I shall have Ulysses write this night to tell your sister that you've come safe here," Jocasta was saying. "She'll have been sair worried for her wee laddie, I'm sure, thinking of all the misfortunes that might have beset ye along the way."
Jamie set down his glass and cleared his throat, steeling himself for the ordeal of confession.
"As to misfortune, Aunt, I'm afraid I must tell you."
I looked away, not wanting to increase his discomfort by watching as he explained concisely the dismal state of our fortunes. Jocasta listened with close attention, uttering small noises of dismay at his account of our meeting with the pirates.
"Wicked! Ah, wicked!" she exclaimed. "To repay your kindness in such fashion! The man should be hanged!"
"Well, there's none to blame save myself, Aunt," Jamie said ruefully. "He would have been hanger if not for me. And since I did ken the man for a villain to start, I cannot be much surprised to see him commit villainy at the end."
"Mm-hmm." Jocasta drew herself up taller in her seat, looking a bit over Jamie's left shoulder as she spoke. "Be that as it may, nephew, I said you must consider River Run as your home. I did mean it. You and yours are welcome here. And I'm sure we shall contrive a way to mend your fortunes."
"I thank you, Aunt," Jamie murmured. But he didn't want to meet her eyes either.
He looked down at the floor, and I could see the hand around his whiskey glass clenched tight enough to leave the knuckles white. The conversation, fortunately, moved on to talk of Jenny and her family at Lallybroch, and Jamie's embarrassment eased a bit. Dinner had been ordered. I could smell brief, tantalizing whiffs of roasting meat from the cookhouse, borne on the evening breeze that wafted across the lawns and flowerbeds. Fergus got up and tactfully excused himself, while Ian wandered around the room, picking things up and putting them down. Rollo, bored with indoors, sniffed his way industriously along the doorsill, watched with open dislike by the fastidious butler. The house and all its furnishings were simple but well-crafted, beautiful, and arranged with something more than just taste. I realized what lay behind the elegant proportions and graceful arrangements when Ian stopped abruptly by a large painting on the wall.
"Auntie Jocasta," he exclaimed, turning eagerly to face her. "Did you paint this? It's got your name on it."
I thought a sudden shadow crossed her face, but then she smiled again.
"The view of the mountains? Aye, I always loved the sight of them. I'd go with Hector when he went up into the back country to trade for hides. We'd camp in the mountains and set up a great blaze of a bonfire, with the servants keeping it going day and night as a signal. And within a few days, the red savages would come down through the forest and sit by the fire to talk and to drink whiskey and trade. And I would sit by the hour with my sketchbook and my charcoals, drawing everything I could see."
She turned, nodding toward the far end of the room.
"Go and look at that one in the corner, laddie. See, can you find the Indian I put in it, hiding in the trees?"
Jocasta finished her whiskey and set down her glass. The butler offered to refill it, but she waved him away without looking at him. He set down the decanter and vanished quietly into the hall.
"Aye, I love the sight of the mountains," Jocasta said again softly. "They're none so black and barren as Scotland, but the sun on the rocks and the mist in the trees did remind me of Leoch now and then."
She shook her head then and smiled a bit too brightly at Jamie.
"But this has been home for a long time now, nephew, and I hope you will consider it yours as well."
We had little other choice, but Jamie bobbed his head, murmuring something dutifully appreciative in reply. He was interrupted, though, by Rollo, who raised his head with a startled "Wuff!"
"What is it, dog?"
said Ian, coming to stand by the big wolf dog.
"D'you smell something?"
Rollo was whining, staring out into the shadowy flower border and twitching his thick ruff with unease. Jocasta turned her head toward the open door and sniffed audibly, fine nostrils flaring.
"It's a skunk," she said.
"A skunk?"
Ian whirled to stare at her, appalled.
"They come so close to the house."
Jamie had got up in a hurry and gone to peer out into the evening.
"I dinna see it yet," he said.
His hand groped automatically at his belt, but of course he wasn't wearing a dirk with his good suit. He turned to Jocasta.
"Have you any weapons in the house, Aunt?"
Jocasta's mouth hung open.
"Aye," she said, "plenty, but..." "Jamie," I said, "a skunk isn't..."
Before either of us could finish, there was a sudden disturbance among the snapdragons in the herbaceous border, the tall stalks waving back and forth. Rollo snarled, and the hackles stood up on his neck.
"Rollo!"
Ian glanced round for a makeshift weapon, seized the poker from the fireplace, and, brandishing it above his head, made for the door.
Wait, Ian.
Jamie grabbed his nephew's upraised arm.
Look!
A wide grin spread across his face, and he pointed to the border. The snapdragons parted, and a fine fat skunk strolled into view, handsomely striped in black and white, and obviously feeling that all was right with his personal world.
"What's a skunk?"
Ian asked incredulously.
"Why, that's no but a bitty wee stinker like a polecat."
He wrinkled his nose with an expression between amusement and disgust.
"Phew! And here I thought it was a dangerous huge beastie!"
The skunk's satisfied insouciance was too much for Rollo, who pounced forward, uttering a short, sharp bark. He feinted to and fro on the terrace, growling and making short lunges at the skunk, who looked annoyed at the racket.
"Ian,"
I said, taking refuge behind Jamie, "call off your dog. Skunks are dangerous."
"They are?"
Jamie turned a look of puzzlement on me.
"But what?"
"Polecats only stink," I explained. "Skunks? Ian, no, let it alone and come inside." Ian, curious, had reached out and prodded the skunk with his poker. The skunk, offended at this unwarranted intimacy, stamped its feet and elevated its tail. I heard the noise of a chair sliding back and glanced behind me. Jocasta had stood up and was looking alarmed, but made no move to come to the door.
"What is it?" she said. "What are they doing?"
To my surprise, she was staring into the room, turning her head from one side to the other, as though trying to locate someone in the dark. Suddenly, the truth dawned on me, her hand on the butler's arm, her touching Jamie's face in greeting, the glass put ready for her grasp, and the shadow on her face when Ian talked of her painting. Jocasta Cameron was blind. A strangled cry and a piercing yelp jerked me back to more pressing issues on the terrace. A tidal wave of acrid scent cascaded into the room, hit the floor, and boiled up around me like a mushroom cloud. Choking and gasping, eyes watering from the reek, I groped blindly for Jamie, who was making breathless remarks in Gaelic. Above the cacophony of groaning and piteous yowling outside, I barely heard the small ting of Jocasta's bell behind me.
"Ulysses," she said, sounding resigned, "you'd best tell cook the dinner will be late." "It was luck that it's summer, at least," Jocasta said at breakfast next day. "Think if it had been winter and we had to keep the doors closed."
She laughed, showing teeth in surprisingly good condition for her age.
"Why," Ian murmured, "please, may I have more toast, ma'am?"
He and Rollo had been first soused in the river, then rubbed with tomatoes from the burgeoning vines that overgrew the necessary house out back. The odour-reducing properties of these fruits worked as well on skunk oil as on the lesser stinks of human waste, but in neither case was the neutralising effect complete. Ian sat by himself at one end of the long table, next to an open French door. But I saw the maid who brought his toast to him wrinkle her nose unobtrusively as she set the plate before him. Perhaps inspired by Ian's proximity and a desire for open air, Jocasta suggested that we might ride out to the turpentine works in the forest above River Run.
"It's a day's journey there and back, but I think the weather will keep fine."
She turned toward the open French window, where bees hummed over an herbaceous border of goldenrod and phlox.
"Hear them,"
she said, turning her slightly off-kilter smile toward Jamie.
"The bees do say it will be hot and fair."
"You have keen ears, Madame Cameron,"
Fergus said politely.
"If I may be permitted to borrow a horse from your stable, though, I should prefer to go into the town myself."
I knew he was dying to send word to Massali in Jamaica. I had helped him to write a long letter the night before, describing our adventures and safe arrival. Rather than wait for a slave to take it with the week's mail, he would much rather post it with his own hands.
"Indeed, and you may, Mr. Fergus," Jocasta said graciously.
She smiled round the table generally.
"As I said,
You must all consider River Run as you would your own home.
Jocasta plainly meant to accompany us on the ride. She came down dressed in a habit of dark green muslin, the girl named Phaedra coming behind, carrying a hat trimmed to match with velvet ribbon. She paused in the hall, but instead of putting on the hat at once, she stood still while Phaedra tied a strip of white linen firmly round her head, covering her eyes.
"I can see nothing but light," she explained. "I canna make out objects at all. Still, the light of the sun causes me pain, so I must shield my eyes when venturing out. Are you ready, my dears?"
That answered some of my speculations concerning her blindness, though didn't entirely assuage them. Retinitis pigmentosum? I wondered with interest as I followed her down the wide front hall. Or perhaps macular degeneration, though glaucoma was perhaps the most likely possibility. Not for the first time, or the last, I was sure. My fingers curved around the handle of an invisible ophthalmoscope, itching to see what couldn't be seen with eyes alone. To my surprise, when we went out to the stable block, a mare was standing ready saddled for Jocasta, rather than the carriage I had expected. The gift of charming horses ran strong in the Mackenzie line. The mare lifted her head and whickered at the sight of her mistress, and Jocasta went to the horse at once, her face alight with pleasure.
"Kimara how," she said, stroking the soft Roman nose. "This will be my sweet Corinna. Is she not a dear lassie?"
Reaching in her pocket, she pulled out a small green apple, which the horse accepted with delicate pleasure.
"And have they seen to your knee, Mokria?"
Stooping, Jocasta ran a hand down the horse's shoulder and leg to just inside the knee, finding and exploring a healing scar with expert fingers.
"What say you, nephew? Is she sound? Can she stand a day's ride?"
Jamie clicked his tongue, and Corinna obligingly took a step toward him, clearly recognizing someone who spoke her language. He took a look at her leg, took her bridle in hand, and with a word or two in soft Gaelic, urged her to walk. Then he pulled her to a halt, swung into the saddle, and trotted gently twice round the stable yard, coming to a stop by the waiting Jocasta.
"Aye," he said, stepping down. "She's canty enough, aunt. What did her the injury?" "Happen as it was a snake, sir," said the groom,
a young black man who had stood back, intently watching Jamie with the horse.
"Not a snake bite, surely," I said, surprised.
"It looks like a tear, as though she'd caught her leg on something." He looked at me with raised brows, but nodded with respect.
"Aye, mum, that it was. 'Twas a month past I heard the last let out a rare skellock, and such a kebby lebby o' banging and crashing as you'd think the whole stable was coming doon about my head. When I rushed to see the trouble, I found the bloody corpse of a great poison snake lying crushed in the straw beneath the manger. The manger was all dashed to pieces, and the wee lassie quivering in the corner, the blood streaming doon her leg from a splinter where she'd got herself."
He glanced at the horse with obvious pride.
"Oh, such a brave wee creature as you are, lass." "The great poisonous snake was perhaps a foot long," Jocasta said to me in a dry undertone, "and a simple green garden snake forby. But the foolish thing's got a morbid dread of snakes. Let her see one, and she loses her head entirely."
She cocked her head in the direction of the young groom and smiled.
"Wee Josh is none so fond of them either, is he?"
The groom grinned in answer.
"No, ma'am," he said. "I canna fool the creatures nae more than my lassie."
Ian, who had been listening to this exchange, couldn't hold back his curiosity any longer.
"Where'd you come from, man?"
he asked the groom, peering at the young man in fascination. Josh wrinkled his brow.
"Come from? I dinna come... Oh, aye, I take your meaning now. I was born up river on Mr. George Burnett's place. Miss Joe brought me 2 year past the Eastertide."
"And I think we may assume that Mr. Burnett himself was conceived within Crow's Flight of Aberdeen," Jamie said softly to me.
"Aye."
River Run took in quite a large territory, including not only its prime riverfront acreage,
but a substantial chunk of the longleaf pine forest that covered a third of the colony. In addition, Hector Cameron had cannily acquired land containing a wide creek, one of many that flowed into Cape Fear. Thus provided not only with the valuable commodities of timber, pitch, and turpentine, but with a convenient means of getting them to market, it was little wonder that River Run had prospered, even though it produced only modest quantities of tobacco and indigo. Though the fragrant fields of green tobacco through which we rode looked more than modest to me.
"There's a wee mill," Jocasta was explaining as we rode, "just above the joining of the creek and the river. The sawing and shaping are done there, and then the boards and barrels are sent downriver by barge to Wilmington. It's no great distance from the house to the mill by water, if you choose to row upstream, but I thought to show ye a bit of the country instead."
She breathed the pine-scented air with pleasure.
"It's been a time since I was out myself."
It was pleasant country. Once in the pine forest, it was much cooler, the sun blocked out by the clustered needles overhead. Far overhead, the trunks of the trees soared upward for 20 or 30 feet before branching out. No great surprise to hear that the largest part of the mill's output was masts and spars made for the Royal Navy. River Run did a great deal of business with the Navy, it seemed, judging from Jocasta's conversation. Masts, spars, laths, timbers, pitch, turpentine, and tar. Jamie rode close by her side, listening intently as she explained everything in detail, leaving me and Ian to trail behind. Evidently she had worked closely with her husband in building River Run. I wondered how she managed the place by herself, now that he was gone.
"Look," Ian said, pointing. "What's that?"
I pulled up and walked my horse, along with his, to the tree he had pointed out. A great slab of bark had been taken off, exposing the inner wood for a stretch of 4 feet or more on one side. Within this area, the yellow-white wood was cross-hatched in a sort of herringbone pattern, as though it had been slashed back and forth with a knife.
"We're near," Jocasta said.
Jamie had seen us stop, and they had ridden back to join us.
"That will be a turpentine tree you're seeing. I smell it."
We all could. The scent of cut wood and pungent resin was so strong that even I could have found the tree blindfolded. Now that we had stopped, I could hear noises in the distance, the rumblings and thumps of men at work, the chunk of an axe, and voices calling back and forth. Breathing in, I also caught a whiff of something burning. Jocasta edged Coroner close to the cut tree.
"Here," she said,
touching the bottom of the cut, where a rough hollow had been chiselled out of the wood.
"We call it the box. That's where the sap and the raw turpentine drip down and collect. This one is nearly full. There'll be a sleeve along soon to dip it out."
No sooner had she spoken than a man appeared through the trees, a slave dressed in no more than a loincloth, leading a large white mule with a broad strap slung across its back, a barrel suspended on either side. The mule stopped dead when he saw us, flung back his head, and brayed hysterically.
"That will be Clarence," Jocasta said, loudly enough to be heard above the noise. "He likes to see folk." "And who is that with him? Is it you, Pompey?"
"Awesome. It's me."
The slave gripped the mule by the upper lip and gave it a vicious twist.
"Leave for, sir."
As I made the mental translation of this expression into "leave off, you bastard," the man turned toward us, and I saw that his slurred speech was caused by the fact that the lower left half of his jaw was gone. His face below the cheekbone simply fell away into a deep depression filled with white scar tissue. Jocasta must have heard my gasp of shock, or only have expected such a response, for she turned her blindfold toward me.
"It was a pitch explosion. Fortunate he wasn't killed. Come, we're near the works."
Without waiting for her groom, she turned her horse's head expertly and made off through the trees toward the scent of burning. The contrast of the turpentine works with the quiet of the forest was amazing.
a large clearing full of people, all in a hum of activity. Most were slaves, dressed in the minimum of clothing, limbs and bodies smudged with charcoal.
"Is anyone at the sheds?"
Jocasta turned her head toward me. I rose in my stirrups to look. At the far side of the clearing, near a row of ramshackle sheds, I caught a flash of colour. Three men in the uniform of the British Navy, and another in a bottle-green coat.
"That will be my particular friend," Jocasta said, smiling in satisfaction at my description. "Mr. Farquhar Campbell. Come, nephew, I should like you to meet him."
Seen up close, Campbell proved to be a man of 60 or so, no more than middle height, but with that particular brand of leathery toughness that some Scotsmen exhibit as they age. Not so much a weathering as a tanning process that results in a surface like a leather targe, capable of turning the sharpest blade. Campbell greeted Jocasta with pleasure, bowed courteously to me, acknowledged Ian with a flick of a brow, then turned the full force of his shrewd grey eyes on Jamie.
"It's very pleased I am that you're here, Mr. Fraser," he said, extending his hand. "Very pleased indeed. I've heard a deal about you ever since your aunt learned of your intentions to visit River Run."
He appeared sincerely delighted to meet Jamie, which struck me as odd. Not that most people weren't happy to meet Jamie. He was quite a prepossessing man, if I did say so. But there was an air almost of relief in Campbell's effusive greeting, which seemed unusual for someone whose outward appearance was entirely one of reserve and taciturnity. If Jamie noticed anything odd, he hid his puzzlement behind a facade of courtesy.
"I'm flattered that you should have spared a moment's thought to me, Mr. Campbell."
Jamie smiled pleasantly and bowed toward the naval officers.
"Gentlemen, I'm pleased to make your acquaintance as well."
Thus given an opening, a chubby, frowning little person named Lieutenant Wolfe and his two ensigns made their introductions, and after perfunctory bows dismissed me and Jocasta from mind and conversation, turning their attention at once to a discussion of board feet and gallons. Jamie lifted one eyebrow at me with a slight nod toward Jocasta, suggesting in marital shorthand that I take his aunt and bugger off while business was conducted. Jocasta, however, showed not the slightest inclination to remove herself.
"Do go on, my dear," she urged me. "Josh will show you everything. I'll just wait in the shade while the gentlemen conduct their business. The heat's a bit much for me, I'm afraid."
The men had sat down to discuss business inside an open-fronted shed that boasted a crude table with a number of stools. Presumably this was where the slaves took their meals, suffering the black flies for the sake of air. Another shed served for storage. The third, which was enclosed, I deduced, must be the sleeping quarters. Beyond the sheds, toward the centre of the clearing, were two or three large fires, over which huge kettles steamed in the sunshine suspended from tripods.
"We'll be cooking doing the turpentine and boiling it into pitch," Josh explained, taking me within eyeshot of one of the kettles. "Some is put into the barrels, as is."
He nodded toward the sheds where a wagon was parked, piled high with barrels.
"But the rest is made into pitch. The naval gentlemen will be saying how much they'll be needing, so as we know."
A small boy of 7 or 8 was perched on a high rickety stool, stirring the pot with a long stick. A taller youth stood by with an enormous ladle, with which he removed the lighter layer of purified turpentine at the top of the kettle, depositing this in a barrel to one side. As I watched them, a slave came out of the forest, leading a mule, and headed for the kettle. Another man came to help, and together they unloaded the barrels, plainly heavy, from the mule, and upended them into the kettle, one at a time, with a great whoosh of pungent, yellowish pine sap.
"Oh, you'll want to stand back a bit, Mum," Josh said, taking my arm to draw me away from the fire. "The stuff does splash a bit, and happen it should take fire, you wouldn't want to be burnt."
Having seen the man in the forest, I most certainly didn't want to be burned. I drew away and glanced back at the sheds.
Jamie, Mr. Campbell, and the naval men were sitting on stools around a table inside one hut, sharing something from a bottle and poking at a sheaf of papers on the table. Standing pressed against the shed wall, out of sight of the men within, was Jocasta Cameron. Having abandoned her pretense of exhaustion, she was plainly listening for all she was worth. Josh caught the expression of surprise on my face, and turned to see what I was looking at.
"Miss Jew, does he not have the charge of things?" he murmured regretfully. "I havena heard her myself, but yon lass Phaedra did see as how mistress takes on when she canna manage something. A ranting dreadful, she says, and stamping something fierce."
"That must be quite a remarkable spectacle," I murmured.
"What isn't she able to manage, though?"
From all appearances, Jocasta Cameron had her house, fields, and people well in hand, blind or not. Now it was his turn to look surprised.
"Oh, it's the bloody navy. Did she not see why we came today?"
Before I could go into the fascinating question of why Jocasta Cameron should wish to manage the British Navy, today or any other day, we were interrupted by a cry of alarm from the far side of the clearing. I turned to look, and was nearly trampled by several half-naked men running in panic toward the sheds. At the far side of the clearing, a peculiar sort of mound rose up out of the ground. I had noticed it earlier, but had had no chance to ask about it yet. While the floor of the clearing was mostly dirt, the mound was covered with grass, but grass of a peculiar patchy sort. Part was green, part gone yellow, and here and there was an oblong of grass that was stark, dead brown. Just as I realized that this effect was the result of the mounds being covered in cut turves, the whole thing blew up. There was no sound of explosion, just a sort of muffled noise like a huge sneeze, and a faint wave of concussion in the air that brushed my cheek. If it didn't sound like an explosion, it certainly looked like one. Pieces of turf and bits of burnt wood began to rain down all over the clearing. There was a lot of shouting, and Jamie and his companions came rocketing out of the shed like a flock of startled pheasants. "Are you all right, Sassenach?" He grasped my arm, looking anxious.
"Yes, fine," I said, rather confused. "What on earth just happened?"
"Damned if I can," he said briefly,
already looking round the clearing.
"Where's Ian?"
"I don't know."
"You don't think he had anything to do with this, do you?"
I brushed at several floating specks of charcoal that had landed on my bosom. With black streaks ornamenting my décolletage, I followed Jamie into the small knot of slaves, all babbling in a confusing mixture of Gaelic, English, and bits of various African tongues. We found Ian with one of the young naval ensigns. They were peering interestedly into the blackened pit that now occupied the spot where the mound had stood.
"It happens often, I understand," the ensign was saying as we arrived. "I hadn't seen it before, though. Amazing powerful blast, wasn't it?"
"What happens often?" I asked, peering around Ian. The pit was filled with a criss-cross jumble of blackened pine logs, all tossed higgledy-piggledy by the force of the explosion. The base of the mound was still there, rising up around the pit like the rim of a pie shell.
"A pitch explosion," the ensign explained, turning to me.
He was small and ruddy-cheeked, about Ian's age.
"They lay a charcoal fire, d'ye see, ma'am, below a great pot of pitch, and cover it all over with earth and cut turves to keep in the heat, but allow enough air through the cracks to keep the fire burning. The pitch boils down and flows out through a hollowed log into the tar barrel. See?"
He pointed. A split log dangled over the remains of a shattered barrel, oozing sticky black. The reek of burnt wood and thick tar filled the air, and I tried to breathe only through my mouth.
"The difficulty lies in regulating the flow of air," the little ensign went on, preening himself a bit on his knowledge. "Too little air, and the fire goes out. Too much, and it burns with such energy that it cannot be contained, and is like to ignite the fumes from the pitch and burst its bonds. As you see, ma'am."
He gestured importantly toward a nearby tree, where one of the turves had been thrown with such force as to wrap itself around the trunk like some shaggy yellow fungus.
"It is a matter of the nicest adjustment," he said, and stood on tiptoe, looking around with interest. "Where is the slave whose task it is to manage the fire? I do hope the poor fellow hasn't been killed." He hadn't. I had been checking carefully through the crowd as we talked, looking for any injuries. But everyone seemed to have escaped intact this time.
"Aunt!"
Jamie exclaimed, suddenly recalling Jocasta. He whirled toward the sheds, but then stopped, relaxing. She was there, clearly visible in her green dress, standing rigid by the shed. Rigid with fury, as we discovered when we reached her. Forgotten by everyone in the flurry of the explosion, she had been unable to move, sightless as she was, and was thus left to stand helpless, hearing the turmoil, but unable to do anything. I recalled what Josh had said about Jocasta's temper, but she was too much the lady to stamp and rant in public, however angry she might be. Josh himself apologized in profuse Aberdonian for not having been by her side to aid her, but she dismissed this with kind, if brusque, impatience.
"Clapper your tongue, lad. You did as I bade you."
She turned her head restlessly from side to side, as though trying to see through her blindfold.
"Farquhar, where are you?"
Mr. Campbell moved to her and put her hand through his arm, patting it briefly.
"There's no great harm done, my dear," he assured her. "No one hurt, and only the one barrel of tar destroyed."
"Good," she said, the tension in her tall figure relaxing slightly.
"But where is Burns?" she inquired. "I do not hear his voice." "The overseer?"
Lieutenant Wolfe mopped several smuts from his sweating face with a large linen kerchief.
"I had wondered that myself. We found no one here to greet us this morning. Fortunately, Mr. Campbell arrived soon thereafter."
Parker Campbell made a small noise in his throat, deprecating his own involvement.
"Burns will be at the mill, I expect," he said. "One of the slaves here told me there'd been some trouble with the main blade of the saw. Doubtless he will be attending to that."
Wolfe looked puff-faced, as though he considered defective saw blades a poor excuse for not having been appropriately received. From the tight line of Jocasta's lips, so did she. Jamie coughed, reached over, and plucked a small clump of grass out of my hair.
"I do believe that I saw a basket of luncheon packed, did I not, Aunt? Perhaps you might help the lieutenant to a wee bit of refreshment whilst I tidy up matters here."
It was the right suggestion. Jocasta's lips eased a bit, and Wolfe looked distinctly happier at the mention of lunch.
"Indeed, nephew."
She drew herself upright, her air of command restored, and nodded in the general direction of Wolfe's voice.
"Lieutenant, will you be so kind as to join me?"
Over lunch, I gathered that the lieutenant's visit to the turpentine works was a quarterly affair, during which a contract was drawn up for the purchase and delivery of assorted naval stores. It was the lieutenant's business to make and review similar arrangements with the plantation owners from Cross Creek to the Virginia border, and Lieutenant Wolfe made it plain which end of the colony he preferred.
"If there is one area of endeavour at which I will admit the Scotch excel,"
the lieutenant proclaimed rather pompously, taking a good-sized swallow of his third cup of whisky,
"it is in the production of drink."
Farquhar Campbell, who had been taking appreciative sips from his own pewter cup, gave a small dry smile and said nothing. Jocasta sat beside him on a rickety bench. Her fingers rested lightly on his arm, sensitive as a seismograph, feeling for subterranean clues. Wolfe made an unsuccessful attempt to stifle a belch and belatedly turned what he appeared to consider his charm on me.
"In most other respects," he went on, leaning toward me confidentially, "they are, as a race, both lazy and stubborn, a pair of traits which renders them unfit for..."
At this point, the youngest ensign, red with embarrassment, knocked over a bowl of apples, creating enough of a diversion to prevent the completion of the lieutenant's thought, though not,
unfortunately, sufficient to deflect its train altogether. The lieutenant dabbed at the sweat leaking from under his wig and peered at me through bloodshot eyes.
"But I collect that you are not Scotch, ma'am. Your voice is most melodious and well-bred, and I may say so. You have no trace of a barbarous accent in spite of your associations."
Thank you, I murmured, wondering what trick of administrative incompetence had sent the lieutenant to conduct the Navy's business in the Cape Fear River Valley, possibly the single largest collection of Scottish Highlanders to be found in the New World. I began to see what Josh had meant by, "Ugh, the bloody Navy." Jocasta's smile might have been stitched on. Mr. Campbell, beside her, gave me the barest flick of grey eyebrow and looked austere. Evidently stabbing the lieutenant through the heart with a foot knife wasn't on, at least not until he had signed the requisition order. So I did the next best thing I could think of. I picked up the whiskey bottle and refilled his cup to the brim. "It's terribly good, isn't it? Won't you have a bit more, lieutenant?" It was good, smooth and warm, also very expensive. I turned to the youngest ensign, smiled warmly at him, and left the lieutenant to find his own way to the bottom of the bottle. Conversation proceeded jerkily, but without further incident, though the two ensigns kept a wary eye on the drunkard's progress going on across the table. No wonder. It would be their responsibility to get the lieutenant on a horse and back to Cross Creek in one piece. I began to see why there were two of them.
"Mr. Fraser seems to be managing most creditably," the older ensign murmured, nodding outside in a feeble attempt to restart the stalled conversation. "Do you not think, sir?"
"Oh? Ah, no doubt."
Wolfe had lost interest in anything much beyond the bottom of his cup, but it was true enough. While the rest of us sat over our lunch, Jamie, with Ian's aid, had managed to restore order to the clearing, set the pitch boilers and sap gatherers back to work, and collect the debris of the explosion. At present he was on the far side of the clearing, stripped to shirt and breeches, helping to heave half-burned logs back into the tar pit. I rather envied him. It looked to be much more pleasant work than lunching with Lieutenant Wolfe.
"Aye, he's done well."
Farquhar Campbell's quick eyes flicked over the clearing, then returned to the table. He assessed the lieutenant's condition and gave Jocasta's hand a brief squeeze. Without turning her head, she spoke to Josh, who had been lurking quietly in the corner.
"Do you put that second bottle into the lieutenant's saddlebag, laddie?" she said. "I should not want it to be going to waste."
She gave the lieutenant a charming smile, rendered the more convincing as he couldn't see her eyes. Mr. Campbell cleared his throat.
"Since you will so soon be leaving us, sir, perhaps we might settle the matter of your requisitions now."
Wolfe seemed vaguely surprised to hear that he'd been about to leave, but his ensigns sprang to their feet with alacrity and began to gather up papers and saddlebags. One snatched out a travelling inkwell and a sharpened quill and set them down in front of the lieutenant. Mr. Campbell whipped out a folded quire of paper from his coat and laid it down, ready for signature. Wolfe frowned at the paper and swayed a little.
"Just there, sir,"
murmured the elder ensign, putting the quill into his senior's slack hand and pointing at the paper. Wolfe picked up his cup, tilted back his head, and drained the last drops. Setting the cup down with a bang, he smiled vacantly around, his eyes unfocused. The youngest ensign closed his eyes in resignation.
"Oh, why not?"
the lieutenant said recklessly, and dipped his quill.
"Will you not wish to wash and change your clothes at once, nephew?"
Jocasta's nostrils flared delicately.
"You stink most dreadfully of tar and charcoal."
I thought it just as well she couldn't see him. It went a long way beyond stinking. His hands were black, his new shirt reduced to a filthy rag, and his face so begrimed that he looked as though he had been cleaning chimneys. such portions of him as weren't black were red. He had left off his hat while working in the midday sun, and the bridge of his nose was the colour of cooked lobster. I did.